Boker Tov or Erev Tov, everybody. A pleasure to welcome everybody as we start, Torah Moshe begins a new series, Exodus, the ins and outs of liberty. And it's a pleasure to welcome back Rachel Sharansky Danziger to give another one of, I'm sure, a fascinating series. Rachel grew up in Yerushalayim. She has degrees in philosophy and history, has been teaching Tanakh, and, she loves to tell stories, teach stories. That's her MA was on how 18th century American proto-evangelicals told their stories and what stories tell us about ourselves and our self. Of course, Sefer Shmot, full of stories, the story, the foundation really of the Jewish people. And it's a pleasure to welcome Rachel over the next, 10 weeks. We look forward to learning lots and lots about liberty. You shall proclaim liberty throughout the land, even though that pasuk is in Vayikra. But I hope that's okay, that we can have liberty in all the Chumash and all of Tanakh. Bakasha, Rachel.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Kelman. Thank you very much who came today. It's nice to see familiar faces. It's nice to see new faces. Thank you, everybody, for coming. And let's delve right in. No need to delay. It feels almost ridiculous to say, oh, let's learn about freedom and liberty in Exodus, because it's cliche. We all know that this is the book about how the Jewish people who were slaves became free people and a nation. It's so ingrained in us. And I'm not even, and by us, I actually mean beyond Jews. I mean, in the world, the image of the Exodus, the image of the Jews crossing the Red Sea revibrates in world history in things like, the songs that black slaves sang in America about Moses go down the river, in things like certain designs for the Great Seal of the United States and speeches about freedom and liberty throughout the world often evoke images from the Exodus. And it's all about this grand story of a nation of slaves becoming free people. So if this was what we were going to discuss here, liberation from Egyptian oppression, we could have finished our course right here and right now. We said it. That's it. They used to be the slaves of the Egyptians. They stopped being the slaves of the Egyptians. God did some grand pyrotechnical interventions to make it happen. The end. Bye-bye. I'm saving you 9 classes worth of studies, right? But of course, this is not actually the story. What we will see as we make our way slowly through the book of Exodus is that at every step of the way, the book is giving us opportunities to examine what freedom actually is. What does it actually mean to become liberated? Is it enough to just have the yoke of oppression removed? Clue? No, it isn't. You need a lot more than that for freedom to mean something and be real and be something beyond just a geopolitical statement that then is swallowed in the pages of history and never to be heard from again. For the Exodus to come to represent freedom for so many people under so many circumstances through so many different eras in human history, it had to stand for more than just that, just the fall of the Egyptian power over the Jews, over the Israelites. And this is what we're going to do today. Today, we're going to set the scene. We're going to start with the very beginning of the book of Exodus, the first chapter and a half of the book. And we're going to try and see what the very beginning hints to. What does it hint to us that's about to happen? What kind of questions is it trying to instill in us or gift us so we can then take them with us and walk into the pages of the coming chapters and unpack them and learn? What kind of clues does it give us to freedom, to what freedom requires, to the costs of freedom, to the catalysts of freedom, to the definition of freedom? We're going to look for all that right there in that very concentrated beginning, so that in future weeks, we can then take these tools that we can extract from the beginning today and use them to make our way forward. And the first thing we're going to try and understand as we delve straight in today into the text is, what is it, in fact, that the book of Exodus wants to redeem us, the Israelites in Egypt, from? What is the core of the problem? Is the core of the problem that the Egyptians do something? Is the core of the problem lying elsewhere? We're going to start right now. We're not going to delay. We're going to read the very first verses of the book. And this will be the question that hovers. What is the problem? Because oftentimes in stories, and I think fairy tales are a fairly good example of that because they're so clear, what you hear in the beginning tells you, in a sense, what the rest of the story is supposed to change. If we hear in the beginning that a girl named Cinderella is mistreated by her step family and forced to sleep in the cinders and make and do everybody's work and have no happiness in our life, we know that this state of affairs is what's going to change moving forward. If we know that, still a little bit of throat issues. If we know that there's a poor boy named Aladdin who has no money and no influence and no ability to shape his life, lives in the streets of Agrabah, we know that this state of helplessness, of inability to shape the world around him, is what's going to change. So let's see, what's the state of being? What's the status quo that the beginning of the book of Exodus establishes that the rest of the book will then try to undermine? I'm going to share my screen with you so we can read it together. And I am here in box number one for those of you who have it printed, The Road to Slavery. And I'm beginning literally in the beginning of the book. These are the names, Shmot. This is where the Hebrew name of the book comes from, Shmot, of the sons of Israel who came to Egypt with Jacob, each coming with his household. So I just want to point out that already we have a question. Why do we need to know the names of the sons of Jacob? Of Israel is another name for Jacob here. Why do we need to know the names of the sons of Israel? We had this list in the end of Genesis. We already read that part. We already know who came. Why do we need it? The very fact that it's repeating here is drawing our attention. It's almost like a little red flag that says, pay attention, pay attention. The fact we're repeating it means that there's something important hiding in this list. So let's see what's the important thing. Let's wonder. Reuven, Shimon, Levi, and Yehuda. Issachar, Zvulun, and Binyamin. Dan and Naphtali, Gad and Asher. The total number of persons, in Hebrew it's nefesh, souls, that were of Jacob's issue, came to 70, Joseph being already in Egypt. So this is an interesting fact, isn't it? We already knew that. We knew that Joseph was in Egypt first. His brothers sold him down to Egypt, and then they come and join him. And now the retelling is making sure that we remember that. It's not telling us how he ended up in Egypt, but the omission here is very loud. Even without saying directly, oh, Joseph was in Egypt because they sold him. The mere fact we're reminded that he was already in Egypt reminds us of that whole dynamic, of that whole tragedy that tore apart Jacob's family and brought them all to Egypt eventually. But before we have time to explore that, before we have time to ask what were the names of their children, for example, or how many wives did they bring in, or how do you take these sons and make them equal 70 souls? How many of them are wives or children or in-laws? Who's actually coming there? Before we have time to start unpacking all of that, the list is done with and we move forward with the story. We hear, Joseph died, and all his brothers, and all that generation. In Hebrew, Vayamat Yosef v'kol echav v'kol adoro. So the beginning is the list of names of those who came to Egypt, including Joseph, and their death. And then we hear something interesting. But the Israelites were fertile and prolific. They multiplied and increased very greatly so that the land was filled with them. And here comes a little nuance that's easier to spot in the Hebrew. because what it says in the Hebrew is not the Israelites. The Israelites is the English way of saying that. What it says is Bnei Israel, the sons of Israel. Except that if we're paying attention, we can see that the same term, the sons of Israel, has in this moment, in verse 7 of the book of Exodus, changed its meaning. Because we already saw it in verse 1. We saw Ve'ele Shmot Bnei Israel. These are the names of the sons of Israel. And then it gave us the names, right? Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda. Here we're no longer talking about these sons of Israel. We're no longer talking about the famous sons of Israel, the heads of the tribe. We're talking about the Israelites. We're talking about their children and their children's children. This term that started as a literal term that has literal meaning, the sons of Mr. X, whose name happened to be Israel, has now become a category, a group name. Now, there's something beautiful about it, right? It's, you know, we are all the children of Israel. There's something beautiful and powerful about this memory that connects us through our very name to the forefather whose children were the founders of our nation altogether. But at the same time, there's a certain loss here. And the loss is the loss of names. Because while we are still known as the sons of Israel, named after our great-grandfather Israel, Israel, Jacob, the people no longer have names of themselves. They're now discussed in these general terms. The sons of Israel, this group. And what do we hear about them? The description we hear about them makes them sound almost animalistic, almost like a force of nature, more than like individual people who make choices and build lives for themselves. They were fertile and prolific. They multiplied and increased very greatly so that the land was filled with them. This broad them, this broad category of people. So the very first thing we lose in the book of Exodus, before we lose our freedom, which we will read about in a second, before we lose our political self-determination, even if we had that, which is something we can discuss later, we lose our names. We lose that attitude that describes us as individuals with names and identities, making human choices and behaving in human ways. Instead, we become swallowed up in this general description of a group, which, as Susanna Levin pointed out in the chat, is described as ishretzu, somebody who multiplies. And ishretzu is a word that comes from the word sheretz, which is animals like bunnies or like cockroaches that have lots and lots of babies. We become anonymous. We become generalized. We lose the names. In Hebrew, the name of the book is so appropriate because this is exactly what we lose at its very beginning. This is what we need to regain, the names. But this is only the beginning. After we lose the names, we also lose our freedom. Let's look at that together. And I'm now at verse 8. A new king arose over Egypt who did not know Joseph. This verse echoes in Paro's mind the process that already happened in the story, in the narrative. In the narrative, we lost the names of the people, and now the king loses the name of Joseph. He loses the memory that made Joseph a concrete person in people's mind. And he, that Paro, said to these people, look, the Israelite people, Am Bnei Israel, the nation of the sons of Israel, are much too numerous for us. They're Rav ve'atzumimeno, they're more and greater than us. Again, this animalistic description that focuses on the number and not on the individual. Let us deal shrewdly with them so that they may not increase. Otherwise, in the event of war, they may join our enemies in fighting against us and rise from the ground. So they set taskmasters over them to oppress them with forced labor. And they, and now we're talking about Bnei Israel, built garrison cities for Paro, Pitom and Ramses. But the more they were oppressed, the more they increased and spread out, so that the Egyptians came to dread what in Hebrew it says, Mipnei Bnei Israel, the sons of Israel. Once again, we see this description that focuses on their numbers and sounds almost animalistic. The Egyptians ruthlessly imposed upon the Israelites the various labors that they made them perform. Ruthlessly, they made life bitter for them with harsh labor at mortar and bricks and with all sorts of tasks in the field. What we see here in this span of 14 verses is that before there's a loss of political freedom, there's a loss of identity. Before the people can be subjected or oppressed, put under shackles by the Egyptian king, they have to lose their individual identities. They have to lose their names. They have to become this amorphous force that can be described in these generalized terms. Now, we could say that what we're gaining here is an insight into the mind of Paro, that in a sense, the text is giving us, with this subtle transition from names to no names, a key into how the mind of oppressors work. To be an oppressor, to be someone who ruthlessly, as it keeps emphasizing, ruthlessly, and cruelly oppresses people, you need to dehumanize the people to some extent. We know that from human history. We know that because we saw how when the Spanish made it to the New World, they started all these long theological arguments, the gist of which was that the Native Americans were less human than them. We saw how people who enslave other people treat them as less human than them. We saw how nations that conquer and sell those whom they conquer into slavery, as happened in the ancient world over and over again, describe everybody else as barbarians. They don't speak our language, so they're not quite as human and sophisticated as ourselves. Time and time again, in order to really be able to do something terrible to another person, you need to somehow disconnect the empathy link that makes you see them as a human being. We will soon see what it takes to restore that. And I'm not even going into the Holocaust example, even though it's an obvious parallel here. When you decide that somebody is less than human, you can do a lot more than you can do otherwise. But I want to argue that this is not all that the text is trying to achieve here. We're not merely gaining an insight into the mind of Paro. We're also gaining an insight into what the Israelites need to go through in order to regain their freedom. They themselves can't become free from Paro until they know who they are, until they can speak about themselves as individual people with choices and dignity and traits that go beyond the numerousness of the species in this case. They need to become more than they are at this point in order to become free. And it's this process that we will watch playing on the macro level in the next few classes. But today we will watch how its address or how foreshadowing of this process, the process of receiving names as a prelude to freedom, takes place in the life of one Jewish baby. But before we get to that, before we get to the next person in the story who gets a name of their own, which is, of course, Moshe, but we will see that for ourselves together, the biblical text makes things worse. Before things get better, they get worse. Let's look at it together. Now I am in source in books number 2. The king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shiphrah and the other Puah, and I will make a comment about the names in a minute, saying, when you deliver the Hebrew women, look at the birth stool. If it is a boy, kill him. If it is a girl, let her live. The midwives, fearing God, did not do as the king of Egypt has told them. They let the boys live. Paro is no longer willing to simply suppress the people, to put them to labor. Now he wants to start exterminating them. And the way he chooses is very telling, because if you really want to exterminate a race, it's better to kill the women than the men, for obvious reasons, right? Women carry the genes forward. If you kill all the women and you don't let the men take wives or girlfriends or whatever, mates amongst other people, the race will die out. But Paro has a different vision here. And this little detail, the gender of the kids he wants to kill, gives us a key into his vision. The vision is not simply to contain the Israelites. The vision is to absorb them, keep the women alive, and use them as use he fit. Kill the men. We don't want the men. We want them to become part of us eventually. And the key for that is this killing of the boys and letting the girls survive. But what we see here in this moment is the turning point of the entire story. Because what we see is two women who make a choice to disobey. Make a choice not to do the natural, obvious thing, which is to submit to the will of the powerful king, but rather to resist him. And this is huge. This is huge. And in order to understand how huge it is, it requires getting a little bit into what Egypt is. And sorry. Because Egypt is not simply a place. It's not a random place. Egypt was one of the biggest and definitely the longest lasting empire of the ancient world at that time. There were the great empires of the Mesopotamian rivers, or Babylon later, Sumer later, Nineveh, and there was Egypt. What did they have in common? They had in common that they were river empires. They're empires that grew around rivers, in other words, around arable, useful soil, where the main source of sustenance was grain. Grain is something that can be collected and taxed and accumulated, as we saw in the end of Genesis, where Joseph helps Pharaoh accumulate all the grain of the land. And through this control over the food, enslave the people, force the people to sell themselves, first their land and then themselves, into slavery to the king, become property of the king because the king controls their food. The king controls the key to the food. And in those empires, we watch the rise of these suppressive, oppressive regimes, dictatorships. But what it requires in order to survive, what an empire like this requires in order to survive, is for people to accept it. Because at every time in history, there were people who left such empires behind. There are people who traveled away. There are people who took their families, took themselves, and either ran for it or immigrated if the empire wasn't as good at controlling its population, and just refused to accept this way of living. For the Israelites to leave this Egypt, for the Israelites to become free from the yoke of the Egyptians and this oppression that isn't just against them, it's an oppression that encompasses the entire society, really, they need to find in themselves the courage to leave. Now, we will see the growth of this courage in future chapters on the national level. But the turning point we already see here. The turning point is that moment when a person decides that they don't fear the king, that they are free, not perhaps in body, but they are free from fear. Yoram Chazoni, in his book, The Philosophy of Hebrew Scripture, asks a question. And his question is, can we talk about the Bible, the Hebrew Bible, as a philosophy book, as a book that explores ideas, and not just stories with messages, individual messages and individual stories? And he thinks we can, because when you look carefully at the Hebrew Bible, you see that certain stories echo others and repeat certain patterns. And if you follow the echoes, if you see how certain stories start repeating one another, you can start seeing how they are slowly taking a certain message or a certain idea from an earlier story and sharpening it and bringing it forth over and over and over again. And Chazon points out that many of the stories of the Hebrew Bible emphasize the power of fear to curtail freedom. And to Chazoni, the epitome of this kind of message or stories that emphasize this is a story of Joseph. Now, we are used to looking at Joseph and seeing him as an extremely successful individual, as someone who took a horrible situation, being sold into slavery, and used it to do good for the world, to do good for Egypt, and of course, to do good for his own family and to bring them back together and bring them into safety. And we end the book of Genesis with Joseph in a position of power. Joseph is the viceroy of Egypt, whose words shape the world around him. So it's a bit weird and perhaps counterintuitive to suddenly start thinking about Joseph as a man who fears things. And yet, hidden in the story of Joseph at the end of Genesis is this passage, which I'm jumping ahead to box 4 in the source sheet. We're talking about the period of mourning after the death of Jacob. And when the wailing period was over, Joseph spoke to Pharaoh's court, saying, "Do me this favor and lay this appeal before Pharaoh." And this is where the warning bell should start ringing for us, because why on earth is he not just going to Pharaoh to talk to him? Why is he asking other people to appeal on his behalf? But let's see what that appeal is. "My father made me swear, saying, 'I am about to die. Be sure to bury me in the grave which I made ready for myself in the land of Canaan. Now, therefore, let me go up and bury my father, then I shall return.' And Pharaoh said, 'Go up and bury your father as he made you promise on oath.'" In other words, Joseph not only feels that he can't address Pharaoh directly and needs to find other people to appeal for him, but he makes a point in the rhetoric he uses when he tells this story, when he lays down his request, to clarify that the only reason he's asking is that his father made him swear. And Pharaoh, who is his boss, after all, and relies on Joseph's reliability, on Joseph's accountability, has an interest, a vested interest, in making sure that Joseph is the kind of person who keeps his oath. And indeed, when Pharaoh responds to that, he indeed says, "Go and bury your father as he made you promise an oath." And Chazoni jumps on this and says, this proves to us that Joseph may be powerful, may be successful, but he's not free. Let's read it in Chazoni himself. I'm here in the middle here. "Mighty though Joseph may be, he is not free. No longer a shepherd like his fathers." A shepherd in Chazoni is a symbol of the person who can always pack his stuff and go when the society around him doesn't align with his values. "He is instead a servant to Pharaoh in the house of bondage." There is no question, of course, but that this house of bondage remains one of the great political and economic power on earth, with the ability to give life and take it away. And there is likewise no question but that a man such as Joseph necessarily feels himself free as he gives out orders to others. But compelling as this experience may be, it is an illusion. The first among slaves may be powerful, but a slave he remains, subject to annihilation by his master at a moment's notice, at Pharaoh's house no less than in that of Potiphar. When once he is faced with the prospect of Pharaoh's wrath and a possible loss of favor, Joseph is struck with the selfsame terror as a Hebrew slave facing that other Pharaoh generations later. Chazoni goes on to say later that in a sense, Joseph's enslavement, this kind of gilded enslavement where he seems so powerful and yet he is afraid and can't make his own decisions, is a foreshadowing of the much deeper fear that the Israelites will face later. It is a story that alerts us to the fear of Pharaoh's might that operates on the Jews in Egypt to the point that they could no longer do what they knew to be right. It is this fear itself, rather than any action of Pharaoh or his ministers, that is to be seen as the cause of Israel's enslavement. Indeed, the physical works of mortar and brick is really nothing more than the concrete expression of an inner enslavement. And this is why the place that fear plays here is the reason that the moment when those Hebrew meyaldot, those midwives, fear God more than they fear the king of Egypt is such a crucial moment. Because this is the moment when we see a glimpse of a possibility. We see a glimpse of a possibility of change. We see that light in the coming through the crack, and the crack is their willingness to say, no, there's something beyond this. There's something beyond this reality where Paro has all the power and can punish us for being requited. There's something beyond it, and that something is worth this obeying him here. It's worth not asking for permission, as Joseph did, not building the cities that he tells us to build, not killing the babies that he tells us to kill. I want to pause here for a second to share something personal, because I really think that I can't belabor enough this importance of this moment, the moment when we see that fear can be unlearned. My parents grew up in the Soviet Union. My parents grew up, were children during Stalin's era of terror. And my father remembers as a very young child, and it's a memory that since I grew up, I started talking to people who grew up in the Soviet Union, and they all share this memory, all the people of this generation, that he remembers one day sitting with his father and cutting an entry out of the Great Russian Encyclopedia. Now, why did he do that? Why was he sitting there cutting an entry out of the Russian Encyclopedia? Furthermore, why did little kids and their parents throughout the entire Soviet Empire sit on that day and cut, or days surrounding it, and cut out that same entry from the Great Soviet Encyclopedia? Because that entry was about a general, a great Soviet general, who lost Stalin's favor. Now, what does it mean to lose Stalin's favor? First of all, you get killed very fast. Then the people you love get killed very fast or made to disappear. Then everything you ever did needs to be erased from memory because Stalin is in the habit of reshaping the world to match his vision. But what can you do? Every Soviet citizen receives these volumes and installments of the Great Soviet Encyclopedia, and there's already this entry there glorifying the work of this general who used to be one of Stalin's favorites. So what do you do? You, Stalin, or Stalin's minions, send out letters to every Soviet citizen with a new entry about something else in the letter B, something else in the same letter, to put in place of the entry that now needs to be struck from history because the dictator decided that this is no longer the history he once told. So my father's family, like all the families in the all entire Soviet Union, received the letter with a new entry, sat there and cut out the old entry and glued in the new. And I want to draw your attention to this, to the fact that nobody came into their houses to tear out the entries and glue the new. They did it themselves. They participated in the work of their own subjugation. Why? Because if you don't, and somebody comes into your house and sees it, you and your loved ones might be killed, might be sent to the gulag, which is almost pretty much counts as the same, might be made to suffer in myriad ways. You're afraid, and because you're afraid, you do the work of the oppressor for them. Now, I'm not saying they're wrong to do it. I'm not encouraging people to go ahead and resist pointlessly. You need to know how and when to fight. But I want to point out that the truth that fear is the first step into subjugation, into accepting the yoke, thus making the work of the oppressor possible for them, because Stalin couldn't go into every house and kill everybody. He couldn't. Even his soldiers couldn't. He and his whole machine of state relied on the fact that most people will suppress themselves, leaving only the few to be made an example of. This is the first step for subjugation. So to hear, as we hear in this story of Egypt, that, and I'm going back to Exodus 1, now verse 17, that the midwives, fearing God, did not do as the king of Egypt has told them. In other words, that something else was more awe-worthy, most fear-worthy for them than the king of Egypt himself, this is where we see the moment when the first of the oppressed remove their own yoke, remove the shackles of fear that hold them back. And it is very meaningful and important, and this will be something we keep coming back to class after class after class, that they don't just do it because they feel it's the right thing to do. Feeling that it's the right thing to do means that you're martyring yourself. They do it because there's something bigger that they fear more. There's something outside the closed system of Egyptian power that is for them an Archimedean point, a point they can rely on in order to look at the system of Egyptian power and say, this is wrong, and I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to participate in this. And this will be a theme that comes back over and over again as we discuss various stages of the Exodus, of the actual liberation from Egypt, how at every stage Moses and God have to help the people overcome their fear. And they do it by giving them something else to live for, by giving them something else to rely on, not just by telling them, don't be afraid, because that doesn't work. They have very good reasons to be afraid, but by giving them some reasons to fear or respect something else beyond. And so we watch this turning point. And of course, Paro doesn't take it lying down. Instead, he instructs his soldiers to go and throw the babies into the river themselves. I'm here in box number 5, Exodus 1:22. Then Paro charged all his people, saying, every boy that is born, you shall throw into the Nile, but let every girl live. The Nile, the very Nile that is the source of Egypt's power and wealth and the entire oppressive civilization that's built around it, becomes literally complicit in the crimes committed by those in power within this civilization. And here starts the more, if the case of the Meyaldot, of the midwives, was the first little seed of a turning point, this first seed of resistance, now starts a story that will bring actual massive resistance into play. The story of the birth and naming and eventual growth of a young boy who will be named Moshe, who will be the first to receive a name in the story. And here I owe you something from before. I said before that they lose their names, and yet here we are seeing, I'm going back up to box 2, that there are names, right? The Meyaldot have names, Shifra and Puah. It's interesting to note that according to the sages, these are not their real names. According to the sages, Shifra is Yocheved, the woman who will later be Moses' mother, and Puah is Miriam, his soon-to-be sister. And they're not named here by their personal names, but rather by attributes that describe their work. Shifra is one who mishaperet, improves the babies. She takes them out of the woman, heals them, makes them pretty, clean, nice. And Pu'ah is named that because she Pu'ah, meh, meh, like goo, goo, makes little noises, little pleasant noises at the babies. You can imagine a midwife and her daughter trailing along, making faces at the cute little newborns. In other words, even those who have names in the story, according to the sages, these are not names. Like Paro, it's more their official names, their professional names, than their personal names. Paro is the name of all the kings of Egypt. It was not the personal name like Ramses II or something like that. It's the title. And Shifra and Puah are the title of their work. And into this world of almost complete namelessness, we watch this moment. I'm in box number 6. A certain man of the house of Levi went and married the daughter of Levi, Bat Levi, a woman of the house of Levi. At this point, they're still anonymous. We still see nameless people. We're just hearing that their relation to one of those 12 men whose names open the book, the sons of Jacob, Levi in this case. The woman conceived and bore a son. And when she saw how beautiful he was, in Hebrew, it doesn't say how beautiful, it says kitovu, that he was good, which could mean beautiful or could mean something beyond that. She hid him for 3 months. Now, in many stories throughout the history of the world, weddings and especially a wedding that's followed by the promise of fertility or a pregnancy or the birth of a son, is the end of the story. This is the happy ending that we're striving for. Here, it's the beginning. Here, or more accurately, it's the ending and the beginning. It's the ending of the story of anonymity that started in the previous chapter, because as we will see, it'll end with a name. And it's the beginning of the story of redemption. I want to pause here for a second and take a leaf out of Chazoni's book, so to speak, and see how this moment echoes other stories in Tanakh. Or more accurately, I should say, how a different story, several books ahead in the Hebrew Bible, echoes this moment. In the book of Judges, we watch the disintegration of Israelite society. We watch how the Jews who start the book by conquering the land of Israel and establishing themselves in it fall apart into these tribes that don't help each other, that barely can hold off their other nations that overcome over and over again and subjugate them. Time and time again, God needs to call a savior for them to come and help them. And it all starts from forgetfulness. I am here in box number 7 in Judges 2 verses 10. And all that generation, in this case, it's the generation that entered and conquered the land of Israel, were likewise gathered to their fathers. Another generation arose after them, which had not experienced the deliverance of the Lord or the deeds that he had wrought for Israel. In Hebrew, it says, Asher lo yadu et Hashem, who didn't know Hashem, who didn't know God. This description of the death of a generation and the rise, vayakam do'acher, the rise of another generation who didn't know something, echoes almost word to word the description we saw before of the death of the generation of Joseph and the rise of the new Paro who didn't know Joseph. So here in Judges, the Jews, the descendants of the Israelites we're talking about here in Egypt, they're the ones who forget, not their enemy. They're the ones who forget. And through this forgetfulness, they lose themselves. They lose their past. They lose their nationhood. And they become these pathetic groups of people barely surviving. And towards the end of the book that details to us this progression from death and forgetfulness to loss of identity, loss of freedom, loss of self-determination, we hear the following. And I am now in Judges 19. In those days, when there was no king in Israel, a Levite, Ish Levi, again, an anonymous man of the house of Levi, residing at the other end of the hill country of Ephraim, took to himself a concubine from Bethlehem to Yehuda. We might think, reading it, that this also will be the beginning of a happy ending or the beginning of a redemption, right? I mean, it's so pointed that another story that started with forgetfulness and deterioration suddenly comes to the moment when an anonymous man of Levi takes a woman for himself. And yet this is not what happens. We're not going to go into this. This is a different story in a different book. But this marriage, the marriage of that Levite man, if you can even call it marriage when it's a concubine and not a wife, ends in civil war, ends in rape, ends in death, ends in a terrible, terrible civil war. Why? Why is it that that story of a wedding ends badly, while our story, the story in Exodus, ends with the birth of Moshe, with the rise of the man who took us out of Egypt, gave us the Torah and Mount Sinai, and brought us almost to the promised land? The man, the father of our nation as such, in a sense, even if he's not one of the patriarchs. What about the events surrounding his birth made it a turning point from slavery and loss of names to names, regaining names and regaining freedom, while other stories of marriages don't end as well? So the answers are several. And in order to really understand them, we will start by unpacking these events surrounding his birth. And we will see how every one of the actors in the little drama that's about to play out makes a significant contribution And each of these contributions, and I'm just giving you a spoiler here for the rest of the course, each of these contributions is a seed of redemption that we will then open up in the classes to come and see how they play out on the national scale and not just in the personal story of Moshe. Let's start with the very marriage itself. The fact that people get married is not unique historically, but the fact that in the midst of a genocide, a man goes and takes a wife is significant because it means that these parents believe that the reality as it is not the face-all of the world. They believe that there is sense in building a new family. There is sense in having children, even in a world where the fate of these children seems completely terrible. It means that afraid they might be, subjugated they might be, but they are free from despair. They are liberating themselves from the inactivity that stems from despair. The sages want to make this point even more poignant, and they famously say that this story, a certain man of the house of Levi went and married a Levite woman, is inaccurate. And they add into it, they take it, they open it up, and they add a whole other story in. They say it's not just that the man went and married another woman. A man was married to another woman. After all, we know that Moses had older siblings, right? Where did they come from? They were already married. The parents were already married. And then the father, when he saw all those babies being thrown into the Nile, lost faith. He became so desolate that he divorced his wife. He said, it doesn't make sense to bring more children into this desolation. And their daughter came to him and said, you know, Daddy, you're worse than Paro. And he said, how come? And his daughter, the prophetess Miriam, said, Paro only kills the boys. You, by refusing to even try, are killing the girls as well. And according to the Midrash, to the sages, this rebuke is what made him go and take his erstwhile wife again and try again for a baby. But whether you stay with the plain meaning of the text or if you add in that story, the very fact that people are choosing to have babies in this moment in history, it's already a small liberation. It's a liberation from despair. And we will come back to that in future classes. So this is a contribution of the parents. Now comes a contribution of a very important character, the sister. Here I am in box number A. When she could hide him no longer, and we're still talking about the mother, she got a wicked basket for him and caulked it with bitumen and pitch. She put the child into it and placed it among the reeds by the bank of the Nile. There's a very powerful symbolic moment here where the babies are being thrown into the Nile to die, and she is putting her baby on the Nile in the hope of letting him live. But he wouldn't have survived necessarily on his own. Maybe there are other parents who put their babies in a little basket hoping that they'll survive. We don't know. What's important, what we do know, is that he wasn't simply left to fend for himself because someone else intervened. Someone else made a contribution. And this time it's not the parents, it's the sister. And his sister stationed herself at a distance to learn what would befall him. What a striking contrast to the siblings whose actions brought us into Egypt, Joseph's and his brother. Joseph, when he was in the pit, did not elicit care from his brothers. His brothers sat and ate bread after beating their brother, tearing off his ornament of many, his tunic of many stripes, and throwing him into the pit. His brothers sit and eat. Later, way later, when they are suffering the consequences of this in Egypt, they regret that moment of apathy, of cold-heartedness. They say in Genesis 42:21, alas, we are being punished on account of our brother because we looked on at his anguish, yet paid no heed as he pleaded with us. That is why this distress has come upon us. They recognize that this moment of not looking out for their brother cost them. That is terrible. That is a terrible thing to do. And here we see the tikkun, the correction, the redemption of that in the sister who stands and looks out for her brothers. as we will see in the next few weeks, there would have been no Exodus if people weren't willing to care for others, if people weren't willing to literally, in the case of Moses and Aaron, or more broadly, in the case of the Israelites in general, stand and watch out for each other and help each other out. Without this resurrection of siblinghood, all the optimism and lack of fear in the world wouldn't have been enough. So already here we see another seed of liberation, caring for one another and being willing to go out of your way to help other people out. But this is not enough. Just because she's looking doesn't mean that he's going to be saved or named. And this is where another character steps onto the stage, a character who doesn't have a name in this part of the story, the daughter of Pharaoh. I'm in box 9, Exodus 2, 5 to 6. The daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe in the Nile. While her maidens walked along the Nile, she spied the basket among the reeds and sent her slave girl to fetch it. When she opened it, she saw that it was a child, a boy crying. She took pity on him, in Hebrew, v'tachmol alav, and said, "This must be a Hebrew child." She has no illusions. What follows when she decides to adopt him and save him and raise him in her palace, even though the death of just such children was prescribed by her own father, is not done by mistake. She doesn't think, "Oh, look at this cute baby who's been abandoned in the reeds. Who knows who he is?" She knows this must be a Hebrew child. She understands the context. She understands who this must be. And yet she's about to step off the path that her own father set. She's about to stop cutting the entry out of the encyclopedia, to borrow an example from the story of Soviet Union, and do something totally different, totally unexpected. Why? Because she took pity, because she feels chemla. We are seeing here another great seed of liberty that we will explore in the weeks to come. And that seed doesn't lie in fearing God. It doesn't lie like the midwife's actions lie in knowing that there's something more important to fear or feel awe at than Pharaoh. It doesn't lie in siblings caring for one another or in people making the choice to have children despite everything. It doesn't lie in any of those things. It lies in something very basic in our own makeup, and that is human pity. And it's very powerful that the woman who saves Moses through pity is not Jewish. She's not part of this. She's not part of our story. She's not our sister. And yet she becomes our second mother because she feels pity. And here we see another seed of liberty, because when the state, the oppressive dictatorial state of Egypt, tries to tell you what to feel and how to be and how to behave, having a genuine, authentic emotion that you then act upon is already a small act of liberation. The very fact that she allows herself not only to feel what her father doesn't want her to feel and to act upon it, this is the key for change. And this is what happens, because what we see immediately after that is Miriam takes the opportunity, sees the opportunity, jumps out, says, "Let me help you find him a nursemaid." Let's read it together here in Exodus 2, 7, 9. Then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go get you a Hebrew nurse to suckle the child for you?" And Pharaoh's daughter answered, "Yes." So the girl went and called the child's mother. And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this child and nurse it for me, and I will pay the wages." And so the woman took the child and nursed it. The baby and his mother are reunited. There's this moment of optimism, of love. Can you imagine her thoughts and feelings at this moment when this baby that she had to put on the Nile and hope for the best is brought to her own breast for suckling? She gets to feed him. She gets to watch him grow until he's big enough. What we find out later is not only that she gets to nurse him, she gets to nurse him in her own home. And we understand that from what happens later when we hear when that child grew up, she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, who made him her son. In other words, Pharaoh's daughter gave the baby back to her. to nurse for as long as he needed to. She brings the baby back into her home, a mother and a baby united at home, because the parents had hope and the sister had a care and the daughter of Pharaoh had mercy. And even earlier, the midwives had the fear of God. All of this had to come together to allow this baby to survive. And then comes the crescendo, the moment where a name comes back into the story. She, the daughter of Pharaoh, named him Moshe, Moses, explaining, "Min hamayim mishitihu, I drew him out of the water." In other words, she is naming him after her action of compassion. She is interweaving her own moment of stepping away from the system that conditioned her due to her compassion. She's interweaving that moment into his name, leaving us to wonder whether this boy will rise to the challenge and fill this name with its proper meaning, and whether he too will be moved by compassion, free from the indoctrination of the state, whether he too will be worthy of the woman who raised him, which of course, as we will see next week, he very much is. But before I want to wrap up and sum with a very, very interesting idea that Rabbi Jonathan Sacks shares about the name Moshe in particular, pointing out that this was actually not a Jewish name. It's actually an Egyptian name that has a very particular meaning in Egyptian. But before I do that, I will take some of the questions from the chat. I apologize that I'm not going to have time to take all of them. Let's see what I can do. iPad said, attention equals intentionality, repeat of the names. Do you mind explaining what you mean by that? Are you here? I'm just not sure what you mean.
I mean that it was intentional that they went down to Egypt. And that's why it wasn't by accident. It was their intention with deliberate actions.
Mm-hmm. I see. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, that's a very good point. That perhaps part of why we're seeing it repeated, the fact the sons of Israel went to Egypt, is to express the fact that it wasn't just something happened and led them to be there. They made a certain choice. And this is a choice that means something for their descendants. I would also argue that it means something beyond that, because I would say that it means also that they, when they go down, not only do they have intentionality, they have identity. And they're making a choice that many people made in history, thinking that because they're choosing a certain change, they're doing it with full consciousness and with the right frame of mind and with the right goal in mind, their children will continue their path. But time and time again, historically, we see that you can make a choice with full intentionality and even the right choice, but the way it affects your children is out of your hands. A moment. People pointed out that the behavior in the Soviet Union and here, the way fear affects people is similar to George Orwell's Animal Farm, and it's similar to 1984, which I agree with. I mean, it's intentional. Orwell wrote it with the Soviet Union in mind, with Marxism in mind. Deborah Berkowi asked, is there any relationship between Vashti's refusal to appear for the king's party and the acts of defiance of the midwives? That's an interesting question. You could say that there is a connection here. Where I would say there is definitely a connection is between Vashti's refusal and Joseph's refusal to sleep with Potiphar's wife. In both of these cases, the biblical storyteller uses the word yema'en or tema'en, which is a very fancy way of saying they refused to do something. It's not the normal way of spreading. It's not the sarev. It's not the itnagda. It's a very, very particular verb that appears rarely and appears in both of those cases, linking them together, making it very clear for us that something about Vashti's refusal echoes Joseph's refusal to sleep with his boss's wife. And this linkage is part of what sages assume that the king asked Vashti to appear naked. And like they, in their interpretation, they say that there was something sexual, a sexual undertone in the way she was asked to present herself, because they're comparing it to Joseph's story, which of course also lends her actions a certain nobility, a certain power, the power to refuse inappropriate order. Why then the sages go and describe her as a terrible, terrible woman is an interesting question for a different class. One more question, and then I have to wrap up, and I promised you something about Moses. Karen Analik asked, is this a foreshadowing that the final redemption will be heralded by women? Is this her only hope? So, by the way, yes, I would say yes. The fact that other than taking his wife and marrying her, which is attributed to a man of Levi, all the actors in the drama that follows are women, is indeed extremely important and will definitely echo over and over again later, even though it will be Moses who's the big guy with the big shots, right? Like making all the big calls, following God, talking to God, doing that. Women play an extremely important role in the Exodus and in the liberation, and we will discuss that at length in future meetings. For now, I have sadly to wrap up, and I would like to share with you Rabbi Sacks' idea about the name Moshe. He points out that Moses, Meseh, means child in Egyptian. The most famous, Egyptian king, Ramses II, who most scholars think was the king of Egypt at the time of the Exodus, a king who presented himself as a god, who built temples to his own divinity, who assembled and accumulated enormous riches. His name means Ramses, the child of the god Ra. And the Bible presents his counter in a man named, not child of God, but rather child. And here is why it's significant. I'm reading here in the source sheet, box 11. Moses, in the form Moshe, Meses, or Meses, is in fact an Egyptian word. It figures in the names of several pharaohs, most significantly Ramses himself. The word means child. Understanding this, we stand before one of the Torah's boldest and most revolutionary strokes. Years later, two men are to be involved in a monumental confrontation, Ramses and Moses. Their names tell us what is at stake. Ramses means child of the sun god Ra. Ramses saw himself as God. Moses was simply, anonymously, a child. It is not one man, a supreme ruler, who is in the image of God, but every man, woman, and child on the face of the earth. And here we come full circle to the beginning of our class. We started by seeing that the first problem that happens, the first loss, is not the loss of liberty, it's the loss of names. It's a loss of identity. It's a loss of a distinguishing way of talking about people as individuals who makes intentional choices, rather describing them in these generalizing, almost animalistic terms, as a force of nature almost. What we will need to regain in order to leave Egypt behind is our names. The first to regain a name here is Moses, but his name itself symbolizes the fact that it's not Moses, the man with a particular biography we should pay attention to. It's Moses as a symbol of every man, woman, and child, every member of this anonymous, animalistic mass of people. Every one of them has to gain their name because every one of them is made in the image of God. And it is the image of God and the fear of God and those feelings of compassion and siblinghood and care and hope that the image of God instills in us that will allow us to take all these seeds of liberty we see in the very beginning and develop them into a truly remarkable national liberation that will be remembered through all of history to come. So thank you so much. And I'm looking forward to seeing you in a week to see how these seeds start sprouting, first in Moses's life and then in the life of the Israelites in general.
Thank you. Very inspiring.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rochelle. Okay, and 55 minutes, Rabbi Alex Israel will be continuing his series on Eliyahu, Prophet of Fire. So everybody, I guess I won't close the the Zoom thing. You can keep it on, I guess, if you'd like. You can go off, come back, or keep it on. Just turn off your video, whatever you're more comfortable with. And we look forward to learning with you. And please invite a friend. And I mentioned before all the upcoming classes tomorrow and the rest of the week. Begin tomorrow, 11 a.m. and up in Kellner on the Rambam and Rabbi Yehuda Levi and Attitude Towards Non-Jews, Selam Elohim. And then our trip to Italy, our virtual trip to Italy with Mark Shapiro at 2 p.m. and Moshe Sokolo. And then there are three classes on Thursday, one on Friday. So Sunday, Rabbi Liebtag's back, of course. And we look forward to learning with you. And like I say, please invite a friend. That's my number one request. Invite a friend to come to one of the classes. And okay, we look forward to learning with you soon. All right, everybody, have a wonderful day, a wonderful week, a wonderful month. It's Purim. Time to, enjoy Purim Katan, okay? Right as we started. Okay. Rachel, thank you. Okay, regards, be well. All the best. Bye-bye.